This is The Stark Truth, hosted by Robert Stark. Brought to you by StarkTruthRadio.com. Robert Stark is an American journalist and political commentator. You can listen to his podcast at www.StarkTruthRadio.com.
This is Robert Stark. I'm joined here with Ashley Messenger. He is based out of the UK and writes for Brandon Adamson's altleft.com. Ashley, it's great having you on.
Thanks for having me.
And I'm also joined here with Brandon Adamson himself.
Yeah, it's been a while. It's good to be back.
So, Brandon, this website was originally your own project, but now you have a number of different people writing for you.
Yeah, I have other people who contribute now. Ashley and one of the I mean, other people are still welcome to contribute too. I don't like just letting anyone contribute because, you know, some of us, like, our views are somewhat unique, so it's like you're not going to get people who are similar, really, if you just let anyone do it.
And I noticed you changed the moniker. Instead of the left wing of the alt-right, it's now left of the alt-right.
Yeah, because I think as time went on, it was just it used to be kind of that we were kind of people like us were kind of vaguely like on the fringes of the alt-right, but since the alt-right kind of, like, became more defined and it shrank, like, suddenly we're, like, you know, way on the outside of it, actually, now, because it's now that it's associated with, like, you know, white Sharia and bringing back prohibition and banning pornography and all of this other, this weird, like, Westboro Baptist kind of stuff, and also it's my conception of it is completely different now than it was 3 or 4 years ago.
Yeah. Ashley,
so that kind of changed it to the left of the alt-right, meaning that it's, like, you know, on the outside of it, not so much like a faction within it anymore.
So you're the alt-center then?
Yeah, well, these labels don't really mean anything. It's just
yeah.
You know, I think that it's important that, like, these the distinctions no longer seem as, like, nuanced or trivial as they did maybe a couple of years ago when we did those podcasts with, like, Greg Johnson and Millennial Woes.
Yeah.
Ashley, can you talk about how your political views evolved to where you are now, and how did you get involved with writing for Brandon's site, and how did you become aware of him?
Sure, so I'll give some biography, although obviously not my entire life, because that'll be quite tedious. I think the first time I started thinking seriously about non-PC politics was in, early 2015. It was in the wake of the Charlie Hebdo massacre incident, however you want to say it. And I don't know if that particular event has been as influential to that many people. I don't see many people talking about it these days, but people have various opinions about what the cartoonists themselves were doing, whether it was childish or if they were asking for trouble. I remember Millennial Woes saying something to that effect, and I can see the validity in that, but nevertheless, the way that several acquaintances of mine in the real world, I guess, reacted to it, just this whole hippie-ish peace and love narrative and singing John Lennon's Imagine, that there's that just annoying, odious guy who seems to just spend all his time, like, gallivanting around Europe waiting for a terrorist attack to happen so that he can then set up his piano and sing John Lennon's Imagine. Huh. And, yeah. So, basically, there was just something about all of that that I found quite unsatisfying and gross. So from then on, I became pretty anti-Islam of the standard sort of Paul Joseph Watson variety, which is a little embarrassing now that I look back on it, but I guess it's a phase that a lot of people go through.
So prior to that event, were you more of a liberal or a mainstream conservative or apolitical?
I guess I remember I went through an anarcho-communist phase, but that only lasted like 3 months, and I was 15 at the time, so... But other than that, yes, I suppose a sort of mainstream liberal type.
How did you discover Brandon Adamson's work, and how did you start kind of identifying with sort of his ideology, which he describes as the left wing of the alt-right?
Yeah, so nothing notable really happened until early 2016. That was when I found, I guess, the HB Deosphere, and that was kind of a stepping stone to the alt-right and to a somewhat lesser extent NRX, which I discovered later that year. I became interested in right advocacy in, I guess, mid to late 2016. And then in 2017, that was the year when I became really disillusioned with the whole thing, with the alt-right. I was subscribed to Millennial Woes at the time, and I saw that interview with Brandon Adamson, although I think he went by Rabbit at that time. I can't really remember.
And, yeah, he did.
That's right. Yeah.
And anyway, shortly thereafter, he and I started talking through the now-defunct website called vid.me, which I think it's kind of a shame it went down. It was quite nice.
Oh, it was awesome. It was awesome. I loved the aesthetic of it. It was just it was beautiful. Like, these other, like, YouTube clone sites are just, like, I mean, they're probably really nice and everything, but they're just, like, so ugly. You know, vid.me was just, like, it just did it look just so legit, like,
yeah,
it really did.
And, sorry, hang on. So, yeah, I found that I had more in common with the alt-left than with most people on the alt-right, and I guess Brandon kind of got tired of my sending him these huge essays through direct messaging, which often exceeded 500, or I think in one case almost 1,000 words. And he suggested that I turn them into blog posts, so that was basically it.
They were being wasted. I mean, he would write these long, like, thought out, like, essay, like, messages to me, and I'd be like, dude, like, you know, this is an essay, like, you might as well just post it on my site, turn it into an essay, and I'll just post this stuff, and I also felt bad, because, like, I'm very kind of, like, really a very, like, short and concise communicator, like, over messaging and whatnot, like, a lot of, like, yeses and nope, you know, nope, yeah. No thanks, you know, or whatever, so it's like, I feel like I wasn't, like, you know, it wasn't handing, like, putting up, like, you know, my end of the bargain or something. So I was like, you know, just, you know, send me these essays and I'll just publish them, you know, I'll promote them for you too. Like, so.
Yeah, I just think it's great that this is growing, because when this whole project that Brandon Adamson started, and it was loosely affiliated with other, it was sort of loosely affiliated with Robert Lindsay. He coined the term the alt-left. And he's gone more in, like, a far left type direction. So this is kind of a very small niche of the online political sphere, but it's encouraging to see that it's growing and picking up new writers.
As far as it being niche, it's funny, like, people talk about the reactosphere, which as a term which doesn't seem to be in vogue anymore, but I actually like it because it refers to just anybody who's outside the Overton window in terms of political positions, and those people are like 1% of 1% of the population, And if you go within that 1% of 1%, we are like 0.01% of that again.
Right.
It's a little depressing, but, you know, you just keep on keeping on, right?
You were saying with your political concerns, is your primary concern radical Islam, or is it just the general demographic transformation of the UK and the West?
Well, as far as the demographic situation in Britain, I don't think it's actually as terrible as people say, although it, you know, it certainly is bad. I think for as long as I've been alive, we've been importing a couple of 100,000 people a year from various places, and that's just from looking at the official statistics, which, well, may or may not be completely representative of reality. I don't know, but I doubt it. And Pakistanis and these other groups constitute about, well, Pakistanis constitute about 2% of the population. Put it this way, one doesn't tend to hear many particularly glowing reports about them. And the police in Britain have, to one degree or another, essentially been complicit in protecting the nefarious activities of this, quote, community. And that's why the whole Rotherham scandal became, well, the disaster that it was. And it's, people talk about it in the past tense, but it's still ongoing, really, in, well, in Rotherham, probably, along with about 1,000 other places. And, yeah, it's emblematic of the larger, more sweeping changes that are going on. There are already places in London and Birmingham and elsewhere that look more like third world countries, and there are vast areas of London. I've only been to London once in my entire life, but...
Oh, really? Yeah.
Yeah, there are huge areas of London, including some areas of quite profound historical significance, where you can walk around and see almost no white people, for example. And something else that's really interesting is...
I was in London for about 3 days, but I pretty much kind of sticked to the more touristy parts, like the West, especially the West End, Piccadilly Circus. I did go over to the Tower of London, and I primarily noticed the demographic issue when I was at the Heathrow Airport.
Yeah. I haven't actually been there either, but... Yeah, I can imagine it's pretty bad from the other places I've seen. I don't think I could stomach being in London for very long. I mean, I wouldn't want to live there. But something else as well. The United Kingdom's population as it stands today is around 65 million, according to most official estimates. There are, hang on, about 7 more million people in the country today than there were in the year I was born. And I realized something quite amazing a few weeks ago when I was looking at just population projections, and I suspect it's a similar situation in the US. I was telling Brandon about this. The indigenous population of the UK, or what's referred to as the White British, is essentially the same size in terms of population numbers now as it was in 1960. It was about 50 million then. It's about 50 million now, which means all of the population growth, or virtually all of it, since the 60s is just because of immigration.
That also, I think, kind of puts a hole in the argument that, like, if you... that people aren't having enough children, and that's why they're bringing in these immigrants to get the... Whereas you see the population does remain relatively stable otherwise. So the fact that it's, like, it's been stabilized, so it hasn't been, like, shrinking down to zero or anything. It's just, they're just being overwhelmed by bringing in, like, millions and millions of people.
Yeah, in California, the white demographics are down to about, I think it's less, it's 40% or possibly even less. And middle-class white people are leaving in droves, so there's been a massive decline.
Yeah, I can imagine so. Robert, if you don't mind my asking, did you at one point live in Los Angeles?
Yeah, that's where I was born and lived for pretty much most of my life.
Yeah, I was going to say, because I assumed that for some reason that you'd moved there. I guess it's kind of like Las Vegas in this regard. To a non-American, one imagines that nobody is really born in these places. They just move to them. But yeah, I was going to ask something like, oh, you know, why did you choose of your own free will to live in the smoggy pit of Los Angeles? Because that's some kind of, yeah.
Well, I lived in Los Angeles, too. I loved it when I was living there. And that was in, like, 1999. And even then, it was like, I remember when I first got there that even just coming from Phoenix, which is just a few hours away, I remember thinking, like, I couldn't believe, like, how third world it was even then.
Wait.
Because I grew up...
You mean Phoenix or Los Angeles? Sorry.
Los Angeles.
Third world. Like, oh, right, yeah.
Yeah, even when I moved there in 1999, I remember when I first got there, like, I wasn't prepared for just, like, how third world it was. Because I grew up thinking of, like, Los Angeles, like, kind of like these crime shows and things, like Charlie's Angels and that. Like, and when I got there, it was just, like, building signs were just, like, in Spanish and Russian and things like that. It's just, like,
Russian.
You could go to... There were a lot of Russians in Los Angeles and Hollywood, but I would go to a burger place, like a Denny's or something, and it would be like, it would just be like so alien. I think my most shocking moment, I've written about this so many times, was when like I had a Sears credit card, and so I was like, oh, I'll go to the Sears on like Santa Monica and Western and pick up some clothes since I just moved here. And when I got there, it was like, Sears was like, it was just like third world. It looked like a third world, like, swap meet. There was like, the clothing was just all over the floor. And this was like at a real department store, Sears. Like, the clothes, like, the pants and everything were just all over the floor, like, in the aisles and stuff. And I was like, how is this even acceptable? Because I had worked retail, you know, and it's like, they're very meticulous about, like, you know, keeping the store clean and folding. And it was just like, hordes of people and just clothing just all over the ground. And I was like, how is this, like, you know, this is incredible, you know, and it just was like a real wake-up call to me. It was like the biggest, like, what you would say, red pill, even though I hate that meme. That's like, it was really just shocking to me when I saw it. I was like, oh my God, like, we're fucked. This place is fucked.
Yeah, the red pill meme, it's interesting to hear you say that. I actually don't like it either. Increasingly, I find that I try to just avoid all of this weird terminology and speak as close
like bugmen, things like that.
Yeah, I basically try to just talk as close as possible to, for lack of a better word, a normal person. Yeah.
What are your thoughts on the right-wing political movements in the UK, ranging from UKIP to the BNP? Do they represent your views?
They're completely useless, for the most part. As far as UKIP and the Conservative Party, I can't really see them going in an interesting direction. It's mostly just the standard kind of neoliberal consensus, or people in Britain actually call it the post-World War II consensus. I mean, one of the things that people talk about inside alt-right circles is this whole thing about leaders in particularly Western European countries being childless, and the implication that is that there's a correlation between this and stupid policies. But the thing is, it's really just luck, or it's really just complete fortuity that it happens to be the case at this moment that all of these leaders are childless. I mean, yes, Theresa May doesn't have children, but David Cameron does have children. I think he has 4 children, and he wasn't any better on these issues than she is, so
it kind of reminds me of that meme that people show of Mitt Romney with like his big white family, yet he's one of the worst politicians.
Yeah. Yeah, he does have something of that kind of waspy attitude to him, though, which is kind of interesting.
Yeah, he is He's terrible as a politician, as far as his views go. But he's kind of he represents the stereotype of your quintessential, like, all-American 1950s WASP.
Yeah. The only thing of any significance I can really remember from him was some YouTube video where someone had, like, edited and cut up him and, like, some speech that he was given with Paul Ryan, and they edited the video to make it sound like he was saying, you know, Paul Ryan will provide the resources for us to cut children up with saws, with chainsaws. And that was mildly amusing, I suppose, but other than that, he isn't, terribly interesting. But as far as the BNP, you asked about the BNP in Britain, they are also pretty useless, and I don't think it's going to go anywhere. The other thing is, in Britain, we don't really have an electoral system the same as America's. It's not like just anybody can run, or, you know, even if it's typically a tedious, long, drawn-out process, like something that takes decades for someone to get into a position where they could even think about becoming prime minister or something. And I don't see it happening. And
And I mean, the numbers just aren't there in terms of popular support for those kinds of things. I completely agree.
Go on. You mentioned you were disillusioned with the alt-right. Can you be more specific about what in particular you dislike about the current alt-right and its current formation?
Well, I spent about 1 year following almost exclusively alt-right content and to a somewhat lesser degree on NRX content, or the techno division of NRX.
Right, the techno-commercialist, like, techno-futurist division of NRX, right.
Would that be like someone like Anatoly Karlin?
Yeah,
or like Nick Land.
Anisimov or Nick Land, yeah. And I never really considered myself one of them per se, or either them or the alt-right, but although I find them interesting, I tend to be somewhat averse to labeling in general. But what I mean is, I felt that I identified more closely with them back then. I mean, to give you some idea of what I mean by this, excuse me, I remember reading a post by Brandon Adamson. It was called, sorry, that was a bit strange. I referred to you by, like, your full name when you're right here. That was
I don't care.
Yeah.
That's fine, man.
But, you wrote something called Amalgamy Bears, and you said in that, you know, back when I was in the right, or something like that. And I thought that was a little bit strange, but then I realized it might have been similar to what was going on with me. I was able to identify more with the right back then, even though my beliefs then from now probably haven't actually changed that much, because I thought it was this new thing, you know, the alternative right, and it not kind of the caricature that you keep that you were talking about earlier, that it seems to have become now, White Shuri and so on. And
it also is like it's kind of like back then it wasn't as defined, so it was kind of like there were a lot of different groups kind of like that felt like they were a part of it, and then as it like became more defined, like it became more clear, like that it was like, oh well, I guess I'm not that, you know. So that's kind of that's kind of what happened. As
I remember Millennial Woes actually saying something to the effect that there was a time when, you know, years and years ago, when the scope of what could be considered alt-right was basically a bit bigger, he was saying, and could have included people, even as disparate possibly as someone like Davis Orini. Davis Orini, that most legendary of thinkers. And I'm joking, by the way. But
right.
Yeah, and the I eventually basically just realized that the only people in the alt-right, or the only people who identified as alt-right that I really liked, were the ones who were disliked or distrusted or just ignored, basically, by the rest of them. The hardcore social conservatism in general never really resonated with me.
Are there people, can you mention some particular names?
Well, a recent example, I wasn't gonna, well, a more recent example would probably be someone like Nick Fuentes. Like, you know, people like that. Yeah.
Can you talk about your preference for Swipple amenities and aesthetic preferences, which ties in with the whole sort of more left side of things?
Sure, I love retro-futurism. That's also an extremely white thing, and weird arty subcultures and European classical music, especially 20th century classical music. All of my favorite composers seem to be Russians for some reason.
It's funny you mention that, because my last show was on the film Eyes Wide Shut, and they used the music from some 20th century Russian composer, but I forget his name.
Yeah. And I'm interested in techno-Gaianism, quote-unquote. I think that's in my Twitter bio, which basically just means is a subset of something that's called bright green environmentalism, which basically means technological or technophilic, technologically oriented solutions to environmental problems.
So you're
activism.
Not a big fan of the whole deep ecology movement and Pentelenkoa and that kind of stuff?
No.
Right. Me neither.
Yeah. And I like minimalism and Art Deco and Art Nouveau. Robert, have you ever been to Barcelona? I went there one time. It's filled with all these weird Art Nouveau buildings. Really interesting.
No, the only parts of... I've pretty much been to England, and I've been to Denmark, but I was just, like, really little. This was, like, in 89. But far... Art Nouveau is more common in Europe. It's pretty rare in the United States, but there's tons of Art Deco. I've never been to New York. Of course, they have a lot of Art Deco skyscrapers there, but there's tons of Art Deco in LA and San Francisco.
Yeah.
I think like Chicago, too, might probably have some. I don't know.
And I like the way on Swipple things, I like the way a lot of English seaside towns look, even though I've never actually been particularly interested in the sea, for instance. I've always been more interested in forests and mountains and so on. I don't know if it's a testament to my whiteness, but...
I've been to Torquay. Have you been there?
Sorry, can you repeat the name?
I've been to the town of Torquay, which is like a resort town in the southwest.
I was going to ask, is it in the southwest? I've heard of it. No, I haven't been there. I think my family originally was from that area, like a billion generations ago, the southwest. But
yeah, I lived in Plymouth for about 6 months, and that's pretty much it's more of a working class city. They have they have like a major naval base there, but demographically, that city was about practically like 98% English.
Yeah, and I like Brighton as well. I think PewDiePie lives there, incidentally, which was interesting to me, but it has kind of a reputation, I suppose. Well, I guess it's kind of like our San Francisco, or the closest thing we have to a San Francisco, the gay subcultures there and so on. And so I'm sympathetic as well to a lot of effective altruism type causes. I think Anatoly Karlin talked about it on a previous podcast that you did.
Oh,
with
yes.
Him. And I acknowledge that a lot of the people associated with that are, on the whole, crazies. But I do find it interesting. And I guess I do have kind of a minor disagreement with Brandon Adamson about this. On the subject of imperialism. I don't want to go back to imperialism of the sort of standard historical variety, but well, I guess I'll go into a bit of detail. So when people are talking about the whole brain drain argument for why repatriation from the first world countries of these minority groups back to the to their countries of origin would be desirable, a common counter that you often hear to this is that, yeah, but yeah, maybe it would be good for those countries, but this is a disingenuous argument because, let's be real, white nationalists don't give a fuck about Africa or the Third World. And they have a point, I think, in saying that. But on the other hand, I think there is a case to be made that maybe in the long term it is in our interest. I'm not saying it's something we should do right now. I'm just hypothesizing that kind of, for instance, I'm saying that if Africa had a more functional society, more functional societies, if a eugenics program of some kind were to be implemented there so that they could have more stable societies, then maybe they wouldn't be becoming so overpopulated, and they also wouldn't be as tempted to immigrate to Western societies. And I also kind of suspect, and this is something that Kevin MacDonald and other people like that who kind of take a whole psychological, biological angle to this, they've talked about this. It's possible that this whole universalist ethic that whites have, universalist morality and equal consideration of interests, quote-unquote, which is a term that the Australian philosopher Peter Singer has come up with, which basically just means that you may acknowledge that people are different and have different interests, but their interests are equally worthy of being considered and being attended to. And that's something that seems to be borne out historically, you know, the white man's burden and all this. And I think that may just be inevitable, is the thing. Any comment on that, Brandon?
Yeah, I mean, all I would really say is that the colonizers before and imperialists before always attempted to do things like that, and often they would occupy under the guise of helping, you know, industrializing the area and all of that. I think that, you know, what's missing from the equation though is that really, like, it's not for us to do that, because when we do that, they end up resenting us. You know, if you go in there and try to say, like, and try to help them and say, this is what, you know, this is what you guys need to do, we're going to force you to do it, they'll resent you and they'll end up. So I would just say that if it's, you know, if those countries want to do that, then it's going to have to come from within, and only when we completely stay out of their business will they be able to, and keep them from immigrating here, will they start to get into the introspection that they need in order to improve themselves. As long as they can blame somebody else, or as long as they have someone else to resent it, then they don't have to look inward to those solutions. I don't think that it's worth it. Also, you know, I can't I can't justify sending people to help out in these areas and risk their lives for this. It's just not worth it. I think it's just like I'm not interested in it. You know, if we're going to colonize anywhere, it should be places that are empty. You know, not trying to especially now it's much space. More difficult because these there's now like the blueprint has been established for fighting imperialism and colonialists and whatnot, so that it's no longer possible, right? Like they'll just terrorize you until they have to leave. Like even if, like, the Russians in Afghanistan and these other places, they're just like, the blueprint has been made so that you can't really do that anymore. That's why I think to me, anyways, to a lot of us now, like, a lot of Germany's actions in World War II seem so, like, absurd. Like, did they really think that they were going to, like, occupy the entire Soviet Union? Like, and that was going to be sustainable?
Yeah.
Because that's just unheard of now, because you think that, like, you know, a country just tries to occupy, like, Iraq or one of these puny countries with, like, no real military or anything, and they can't even... even that is, like, almost impossible to sustain. As soon as, you know, as soon as we leave Afghanistan, that place is probably going to descend into chaos again.
I think that it's like... certainly for the foreseeable future, yeah, I agree that... Well, I'm anti-intervention, mm-hmm. I don't think we should be involved with the Middle East anymore. There was this general delusion under, well, the Bush administration, and I guess probably earlier than that as well, that if we went in with our guns and our artillery and blah, 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 that the Middle East was just going to abandon hundreds, you know, centuries, if not millennia, in fact, of a particular way of doing things. And, well, we can see how that's turned out.
For all we know, that, like, they may have actually done that, but, like, our intervention there actually, if anything, it delayed that because it caused a resentment in those they started looking to more toward their own roots.
Yeah.
Ashley, do you think there is a large enough demographic for a, I don't want to use the term, but I guess I'll say it anyway, a red pill to Swipple movement for society? Or society?
I would like to think so. I'm not sure. Like, my interactions with Swipples in real life have been fairly mixed. I guess I have kind of a love-hate relationship with them. And with the English working class as well. I'm not sure, to be honest. But yeah, I'm hopeful about that prospect. And I think more people, certainly on the internet, we're going to see more people like that in the coming years, if not in the next few decades.
What do you think about the whole English working class chav culture?
Well... I think that people have this image of England from outside to a certain extent as a kind of Downton Abbey society with the aristocrats living in stately homes out in the idyllic countryside with, like, the working classes shuffling around under their feet, serving them champagne and caviar and all this. It's one of the most heavily urbanized countries on the planet, and probably one of the most post-industrial countries on the planet. And the chav culture that people talk about, I think there are all sorts of things probably that have contributed to that. It's a bit of a mess, but it's... You know, people talk about the legacy of Thatcherism, and I think that is part of it, but people don't realize that, you know, and deindustrialization, but... The coal mining in Britain was already in decline by, like, the 20s. I think it reached its peak sometime in the 1910s. And then it was on the decline from there on out as a result of partly from external competition and competition with other fuel sources. And I remember Millennial Woes making a video about this. You know, if you tell a guy who's been a miner all his life, particularly if he isn't particularly bright, to just, you know, go off and do something else, it just wasn't realistic, and many of these people became welfare dependent, and the legacy of that is, you know, their children and grandchildren and so on are the chavs. Although I've also heard people saying that there were people like that even before the mining and steel industries in Britain completely went down the drain. So, yeah, it's a difficult thing to parse out.
Yeah, one of the things about England is there's an urban white proletariat. In the United States, the white proletariat is largely rural.
Yeah.
One of my observations goes back to what you were saying, as Americans have this stereotype of British culture as being aristocratic, but there's a strong kind of like lowbrow element to the culture, not just the chav culture, but even just among the middle class youth.
Yeah, Yeah, I would largely agree with that. I mean, one of the things that I've thought about is just allowing, and this is a bit of a mental idea to most people's minds, but just allowing people to legally leave school and start work or training for work at the age of like 12 with parental consent or something, which sounds crazy, but seriously, there are adults in Britain who honestly haven't learned much since they were 12 years old, that they probably should have been taken out of education at that time and taught how to do something, a trade or whatever, anything. And there are places in Europe where you can do that, where teenagers are being entrepreneurs and entering the job market and so on. I don't see the harm.
You favor a secular form of distributism, and distributism is linked with Catholic social teaching, and also it's popular among the traditionalist crowd.
Yeah.
Can you talk about... But you're talking about a secular form of distributism that that's compatible with your views. Can you talk more about your economic views?
Sure. Well, I guess I'm kind of a novice on economic questions, so I'm open to having my mind changed about certain things. But I would say that the thing is, I'm kind of sympathetic in a way to a lot of libertarian concerns, the curtailment of personal freedom and privacy and so on, especially in my country. But it was never really clear to me why a consumerist plutocracy or corporatocracy, however you want to say it, of the kind that exists in the modern West, was the best system to facilitate personal freedom or privacy or the protection of those things. And it also wasn't obvious to me that corporations just know better than governments how to do things. I mean, I just don't see the evidence of that. I remember Brandon retweeting something as well to the effect that, you know, if you, or maybe he just liked it, I can't remember, but it was something like, you know, if you tried to boycott every corporation, every corporate entity that pushed the neo-progressive narrative, you'd end up living like Ted Kaczynski and the Unabomber, and I think that's obviously true. And that, and also things like, you know, the obvious things, I don't think it's possible for an unregulated market to ensure environmental protections, and so I'm heavily sympathetic to distributive economic philosophies, but obviously without the religious aspect, the idea of quote-unquote private property broadly distributed that they espouse, that really appeals to me. Because it would mean that the monetary powers wouldn't be monopolized for nefarious ends either by the government or, as is presently the case, by corporate entities, if that's the case anyway. And also, housing prices, I don't know what it's like in America, but housing prices and rent rates in Britain, especially in the major population centers, seem almost as though they're designed to keep people living with their parents forever.
Like, yeah, that's a huge problem here, especially in California.
Yeah, rent rates in London are fucking mental, and in pretty much every major city. And I'm also interested in, quote-unquote, luck egalitarianism, which is an idea that was espoused by, I think, Lee Kuan Yew, who I have some respect for, and others, which is basically just the idea that you shouldn't be rendered completely incapacitated by your life's circumstances in terms of being born into poverty or what have you. Now, in reality, I obviously recognize that this isn't possible in any absolute sense, because you would literally need to make everybody be clones of everybody else and engage in mind control, you know, to actually fully realize that. But I do think that steps could be made to ensure that, for instance, high-ability people, high IQ people who are born into poor economic circumstances shouldn't have to remain in poverty for the rest of their lives, because it's generally well known that even intelligent people who are born in those circumstances don't usually escape their position. Like,
yeah. One of my observations is that growing political dissident movements are a product of high IQ people who are being cast aside economically.
Yeah, absolutely. And something else I've been thinking about recently as it happens is automation. And Brian Kaplan in The Case Against Education, which I haven't actually read, I've only read about it, and I've read, you know, Scott Alexander's summaries of it, and people have various opinions of him, but he talks about a lot of things in that book, but among them was the idea of the so-called social signaling model of education, which is basically the idea that education is more about giving off signals that you're a quote-unquote high-quality person than it actually is about learning anything or doing something productive. And I think there's a lot to that. But then I also started thinking about algorithms. It's kind of a weird segue here, but algorithms and the way they can be used to predict things like criminal recidivism. And I thought, you know, why does no one use a system like this for hiring people? And that seems to make sense on face anyway. But I don't know of any companies that hire like that. One of the major concerns that people have about that is that the algorithms would start excluding people from jobs who are currently protected under employment laws, like women or people with disabilities of various sorts and so on. And there are people of the traditionalist persuasion who would obviously love that. And the thing is, think of that whatever you will. I suspect these people aren't going to be nearly as pleased about this when the algorithms realize that they're useless too. Because they probably will be at some point, as will we all, as more and more jobs are automated. And this was the connection to Brian Kaplan's book of, I was talking about, the signaling model of education. In our current society, and with automation this will be amplified, presumably, we have almost like a social signaling model of employment or a social signaling model of having a job. Because, you know, why does a janitor do what he does? Well, in the most proximate sense, it's because he just wants money and his employer wants money. But does that job really exist to get something done in, you know, the most efficient way possible? Probably not, because it could probably already be done more easily and more efficiently by a machine. The janitor's job could probably be done better by a machine, and he and his employer don't really need money to live, because in, you know, any Western country you could easily, well, you could relatively easily just get by on welfare. So he's doing his job probably because he's able to do it, assuming that he isn't particularly smart, which realistically is probably often the case, and because he doesn't want the social stigma of being a welfare scrounger. And I think people would probably be shocked if they realized how many jobs we could already fully automate. But the stigma, you know, among other things associated with welfare, makes the problem psychological as opposed to just material. And at some point it's something that I expect we'll have to get over, especially when we get to the point where, I don't know, a third of people are out of a job because of automation.
That's the big thing with the debate about the basic income, is the basic income with automation can take care of people's basic needs, but there's still going to be this strive for social status. A lot of people, as you said, have careers because they want to further their social status.
Yeah. I remember seeing some data published by one of these, the HBD people that I follow on Twitter. It was something like support for the basic incomes, it seems to be predominantly an age thing, a function of age. Younger people, pardon me, are more likely to favor a basic income, and it doesn't seem to be a left v right thing. That doesn't seem to matter so much, which is interesting.
I think also that the social social status thing is that the younger people do not seem to be looking for social status in that same kind of like 1980s like dynasty kind of way that maybe previous generations were. So even with like basic income, like people would still strive for social status, but they do it through these weird ways, like having like a popular like social media account or something like that. Having, you know what I mean? They have like they utilize completely different metrics to to signal their social status and to achieve it. That like an older person wouldn't even care about. Like,
yeah, and posting pictures of food in a smart restaurant or whatever.
Right.
Do you think automation will solve a lot of these problems, such as mass immigration?
How? Like, could you elaborate on that a bit? That sounds interesting to me.
All those low-wage jobs are displaced, then there's going to be less of a demand for large-scale importation of cheap labor.
Oh yeah, it nullifies the idea that we need, you know, slave labor to do the foreign labor to do these things, to perform these less than glamorous, let's say, jobs. And when these things are done by machines, it strikes me that would be an effect of that, yeah.
I would say it won't have that much of an effect, because what we're starting to see, that was the argument a few years ago, is, right, well, these people, they're just doing these menial jobs you wouldn't want to do, and you know, we need them because no one wants to do them. But we see now that the mass immigration, they're bringing in people to do, like, these tech jobs, and, I've mentioned this before, the CEO of Microsoft is an Indian guy, so, yeah, jobs Americans won't do. CEO of Microsoft, right? Like, who would want to do that job and make money? And if you've ever worked in some of these,
well, that's
big,
kind of
like,
what
social
Trump,
media companies, like I have.
Yeah, that's what kind of Trump is promoting with his merit-based immigration, shifting immigration from low-skilled labor to more of the kind of higher skilled or medium skilled jobs.
Right, but it doesn't work, because what happens then is that you're putting these people who have no real loyalty to America, you're putting them in these positions of power, right? You're bringing in these, like, these programmers and CEOs and things like that, and you're putting them in positions of power where they have no loyalty to America. Like, is the CEO of Microsoft or one of these companies, is he going to be, like, he's Indian, is he going to be more or less likely to bring in more of his co-ethnics, or, just on a lesser note, just even family members and things like that he wants to hook up. So I think that it's still, you have all these people that are in power that are going to be even less inclined to respect borders or have any concept of nationhood or something. And basically, at that point then, and the U.S. is almost there, where it's nothing really but just an airport. An international airport. That's really all it is.
Yeah, I remember Ryan Falk saying that the U.S. essentially has an immigration lottery that people can enter into to get visas. Something like that. But, I think to a certain extent as well, it's a numbers game. Like, I mean, in Britain we have a quote-unquote substantial, as in it's 0.7% Chinese population. But it's still only 0.7%, and for the most part, they're completely innocuous. You know, it's not the same situation as Australia, for instance, where they're turning up in huge numbers and really significantly changing things. Or so I've heard, anyway.
Ashley, you wrote an article about Poland and about the alt-right's fetishization of Poland. You pointed out that Poland has one of the world's lowest birth rates, and what's interesting about this is I know Brandon is an antinatalist, and your argument...
No, not really.
Okay.
Yeah, I was going to say, when you said he was an antinatalist, what I associate that with is like the voluntary extinction people, and I was thinking, really? That doesn't sound like him. But yeah, go on.
No, I'm not an antinatalist. I just think that a lot of people in the alt-right, or like the conservatives in general, have this idea that, like, that we're not having enough babies, and that's why, like, we're being overwhelmed by these people, because we have to, like, outbreed them or something like that. And it's just like, that's not something that I see as the way to to deal with these situations. I'm not saying that people shouldn't have children or that like it's bad to have children. I just like an antinatalist would. I just think that like you're trying to win at a game that someone else is better than you. That's you're trying to beat someone else at their strongest game, you know? Because that's really all of that these other people can do is they can just pump out babies. Like that's their, you know, that's their superpower, if you will. So you're not going to, you got to use, the West was never great because of sheer numbers. Like in many situations, it was able to rule over exponentially larger groups with just the tiny amounts of people, especially in colonizing South America. Like, you would go to like an island or something and just take over the whole place with like 100 guys because, you know, because they were so much more advanced. So it's just kind of like, so I'm not an antinatalist. I just think that, you know, having children is fine. It's good, but you, you know, you got to think more imaginatively to, in order to deal with these problems.
Well, it wouldn't be an issue of anywhere near the same sort anyway in a society that had its act together, say, demographically. I mean, Japan doesn't have this problem, and it has relatively low fertility rates.
So what was your main criticism of Poland in the article, because Poland is pretty much basically keeping out migrants?
Well, it wasn't so much that per se, it was more just the fetishization, like that's a word you used, as you say, of their society by American conservatives. And what was really interesting, and this is something that Richard Spencer pointed out as well, that it seems to be one of the very few things that ethno-nationalists and civic nationalists, the alt-right and the alt-light, seem to agree on, that they all love Poland and these Eastern Bloc countries. It's like, isn't it a little weird that this is a country that was essentially on no one's radar a few years ago, and now everybody's LARPing as them and pretending to identify, or at least that's the way it feels to me sometimes, with their ethnic struggles, which are these days just completely non-existent, like with the Germans and the Poles, for instance. It's really strange.
What are your general views towards economic incentives towards natalism?
Well, as far as population goes, like, I mean, as I said, I don't see it as a moral imperative for a country such as Japan, or a country such as Poland, for that matter, to lose, say, a third of its population. I don't think it's imperative that they do that. I just don't buy the scaremongering about it. I mean, as I said, in my country, the indigenous population has barely changed since the 60s. So, say, for the sake of argument, that we returned to that condition in the 60s, I would be happy with either a decline of the sort that Japan is undergoing, followed by just stabilizing at some point, or just a stable population of 50 million, say, indefinitely in Britain. And as far as natalism and economically incentivizing it goes, if it got to the point where extinction really was a concern, there are many ways that reproduction could be incentivized. I suppose you could do what the Nazis did. I sent you a DM about this, where you could basically something that the Nazis did, I think, according to Ryan Falk, was pay off people's mortgages, or a certain percentage of people's mortgages, for every child they had. Or you could do it negatively as opposed to positively by imposing some, I don't know, massive monetary burden on people above a certain age, you know, let's say 40 or 45, something like that, who don't have at least two children. Obviously, it would never get past an ethics board these days. And I'm not advocating that. I'm just saying, you know, if it got to the point where people were really worried about extinction or the like, there are things we could do. So, yeah.
Yeah, I've thought about that as well. And it's something that, you know, people are horrified when you mention. But I think that, like, the way it's set up in the U.S. now is that just anyone, often just like the most idiotic people, like you get tax incentives and tax breaks for, you know, having children, and you get increased benefits for those kinds of things. I think it would be interesting, and this is something that would make, you know, ethics groups freak out, is if you actually penalized people for having children in some way, or at least more than a certain number, you know, more than two or something like that. That if
are
you
talking
actually,
about the proletariat, or you're just talking about everyone?
Well, just everyone in general. I think that right now there's really there's not enough of a disincentive, and this is why I favor things like a consumption tax also, because people always say like, if you're going to do like a food tax or something, then it's going to hurt the poor. And it's like, well, that's good. Maybe that these people wouldn't be so fat. Like maybe they would buy less food if it was taxed, you know, it would disincentivize them, the people, to buy like a gigantic thing of cheese puffs or something like that. If it costs more or something like that, it would disincentivize them having like four or five kids if it was going to, be more difficult.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, people don't seem to care. They just like hump and like pump out babies, and they just don't give a fuck. Like, you know, no matter what you do.
I think there is something to the idea that poor people tend to buy crappy food just because it's what they can afford. Like, I have seen that, but possibly, you know, given the kind of measures that you were talking about, I mean, another thing you could do maybe is have some kind of a living wage, so that people didn't have to buy all this, well, crappy food. That's something that could be interesting. And
I think people just choose to buy it, because I mean, there are plenty of options. I think if anything, it's that some of these people are, it's just another, it's just another aspect of their being unable to just. To demonstrate any impulse control.
Yeah.
So a normal so it's just like they'll just buy all complete junk, not because they can't afford it. There's a lot of good food you can eat that's cheap. You can buy potatoes and vegetables and things like that. They have like an inability to exercise any impulse control or long-term like future time orientation. So they have no concept of being able to moderate themselves in that way. And I think that's really why you see these people that buy this stuff, is just because they don't have that kind of discipline. It's the same lack of discipline which causes them to just like have four or five kids when they're a teenager, because they just don't have any ability to control themselves in that way.
Okay. We are at the end of the show. I'd like to thank Ashley Messenger for being on. He's going to be joining us again for another show coming up soon.
Yes, thank you for having me.
And also thanks, Brandon Adamson.
Thank you.